The people have spoken.
Raphael Warnock fends off Herschel Walker in Georgia, giving Democrats a 51-49 majority in the Senate. It's Wednesday, December 7th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, power is coming back on in North Carolina, and the Supreme Court is hearing a case that could overhaul election law. But first, the Senate runoff in Georgia wraps up the midterm elections with another victory for Democrats. Warnock's win means Democrats in Washington can ditch the power-sharing agreement that has been in place over the last 2 years in what has been a 50-50 Senate. And the defeat of another Trump-backed Republican is giving Democratic organizers hope that Georgia could remain a swing state through 2024. Well, here to break it down for us is someone who knows Georgia politics as well as anyone, WABE's Rahul Bali in Atlanta. He spoke to Scott Tong earlier today.
So as far as the vote tally, was this a tight win for Warnock? We know he edged Walker by just one percentage point back in November.
Yeah, it was, again, a tight margin. But in terms of raw vote total, it was a bigger margin. Back in November, he won with 37,000 votes, but he didn't have enough to avoid a runoff. Right now, his margin stands at 95,000. And there's so many other numbers, Scott, that I can throw your way. But I think the best number to represent what we saw here is Senator Warnock. There's 159 counties here in Georgia. He improved his margin in 148 of those counties. He may not have won all those counties, but he improved his margin. That's Republican counties and Democratic counties across the state.
And is there early analysis as to why? Was it turnout in across the state or in blue areas like Metro Atlanta?
It's going to be everything. When the margins are this tight, Scott, it's going to be everything. It's going to be the turnout during early voting, what you saw happen in urban areas, the turnout with young voters. We saw it may end up being a smaller number than what happened in November, but it may be a higher percentage with younger voters. There was a major effort to reach out to Asian American voters. I was at a Warnock event aimed at Asian American voters. He made an effort. He made multiple stops on college campuses and with the union workers. So we're going to probably hear a lot of different reasons why this happened. When the margin is this close, every single one of those reasons is going to be behind that victory.
Now, the state legislature in Georgia changed some voting rules going into this election. They adopted Republican proposals to reduce mail-in voting time and to cut their number of days to vote early. Warnock suggested these were voter suppression efforts. Let's take a listen.
Just because people endured long lines that wrapped around buildings, some blocks long, just because they endured the rain and the cold and all kinds of tricks in order to vote, doesn't mean that voter suppression does not exist. It simply means that you, the people, have decided that your voices will not be silenced.
Rahul, did these voting rule changes affect the outcome, you think?
I think the one voting change that was made in Georgia's election law that showed up in a big way was this runoff would have been 9 weeks under the old law. It ended up being just 4 weeks. And that meant early voting, mandatory early voting, was just 1 week. So that shrinked early voting window absolutely made a difference. You had long lines for early voting, especially in more urban areas in which lean Democratic. But we also saw long lines in some Republican areas as well. So the shortening of that early voting window, the shortening of the runoff window, it may have made a difference. And that may be a question that Republicans are asking themselves is not as many Republican counties did extra early voting days right after Thanksgiving. Could that have been part of this, again, very tight margin, back to the point of anything could have changed this race?
Yeah. And how about Herschel Walker's campaign team? How are they sorting this all out today?
There's going to be a lot of questions asked. First of all, there's going to be questions asked of was Herschel Walker the right candidate in the first place? There were 9 statewide races on the ballot in November and in December. Republicans won 8 of them, including the governor's race. The only race they lost statewide was the Senate race. So I think the first question that's going to be asked, was he even the right candidate? You remember Leader McConnell bringing up this issue of candidate quality.
Yes.
As for the campaign itself, there's going to be questions about how the campaign was handled. Here in the final days, there was a big, and actually throughout the whole campaign, Herschel Walker took a much more conservative line on the campaign trail.
Yeah. Rahul Bali of WABE. Rahul, thank you again.
No problem.
After the break, as the lights come back on for many in Moore County, North Carolina, we'll talk to the state's governor about last weekend's attack on 2 power substations. Stick around. The FBI and state authorities are investigating that attack on 2 power substations in central North Carolina Saturday that left tens of thousands without electricity. The state's Democratic Governor Roy Cooper is calling the attack malicious and criminal, and he spoke to Deepa Fernandez about it this morning.
This was an attack against an entire community, plunging them into darkness, causing problems for hospitals, adult care homes, traffic signals. Our priority has been public safety and the health of the people of Moore County. Obviously, when you're bringing in generators and having to make sure we have mass feedings and shelters, it's almost like a hurricane has hit the area. But they are anticipating power to be back on in some places this afternoon, in some places this evening. And I have talked with the CEO of Duke Energy and have stayed in constant contact with them. They are working 24/7 to get power back on.
And I think something that many people might not realize is that the water supply has also been affected for some residents, because in the rural area, well water gets shut off when the power goes out. Is that still a big problem for people there?
Well, what we're doing is making sure that people have water available. But yes, when you lose all power, there are a lot of issues that come up. And it shows us that the critical infrastructure, our power grid, we need to look at ways to strengthen it. There are things that we can do to harden our structures and to make sure they are more protected from these intentional attacks. Obviously, this person or persons knew what they were doing, knew that the shots that they fired would disable the substation, and the result has been misery for a community since Saturday night.
Does that make you think, since, as you just said, they knew what they were doing, the Moore County Sheriff Ronnie Fields also echoing that, that this might have been an inside job, somebody who worked at the substation?
State, federal, and local investigators are working in a coordinated way to investigate this incident. I think they are looking at all motives and are chasing down all leads. So investigators are working very hard to try to find who did this. And in the meantime, we want to keep people safe. We want to look at how we can strengthen our infrastructure, because we know potentially this is a vulnerability throughout the country.
So tell me what you think you can do in the here and the now to start fortifying around your substations right there. It is a national problem, you're right, but what could you do and what are you doing there to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again?
Well, first, law enforcement is being very vigilant around other substations in the area, checking on them. We do not have any information of any specific credible threats to any other substations at this point. But many of these remote substations that serve fewer people are more vulnerable. And there are cost-effective measures that can be taken to fortify these substations. And that's what the conversation is right now with our utility companies. We're meeting today, actually, with officials from Duke Energy, our Department of Public Safety, and all of the officials who have looked at this. There have been studies before on hardening structures, hardening substations, doing more to prevent what could just be vandalism. We've had that before, people randomly trying to vandalize these substations, all the way to this type of intentional act where people had knowledge of how to completely disable the substation.
If I may, your state is also at the center of a big Supreme Court case about elections and democracy, and at issue is a fringe legal theory that would remove some of the checks and balances and give much more power to state legislatures in federal elections. And you wrote in the New York Times this week that this theory would upend democracy. What are your concerns?
I have deep concerns how that will affect the conduct of federal elections. And we've seen a lot of schemes conducted here in North Carolina that have made it harder for certain populations to vote. I hope the Supreme Court will follow what Chief Justice Roberts said in an earlier precedent about these issues should be decided by states in state courts.
North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Deepa.
We're going to stick with that Supreme Court case Deepa just asked Governor Cooper about and dig into what independent state legislature theory really means and why it matters. That's after the break. A group of Republicans before the Supreme Court today want to give virtually unchecked power over federal elections to state lawmakers. They're pushing something called independent state legislature theory that opponents say goes against the basic tenets of democracy. The case, Moore v. Harper, started when North Carolina's Supreme Court threw out a gerrymandered congressional map, and the Republican lawmakers behind the map sued. But the case would have implications far beyond congressional maps in North Carolina. In its most extreme form, independent state legislature theory could clear the way for state legislatures to certify presidential electors who were not approved by the voters. Justice Elena Kagan had this to say during today's oral arguments.
When we think about this word legislature, we're thinking about it as embedded in a system of constraints. And one of those constraints is the governor, and another of those constraints is the courts.
Justice Brett Kavanaugh also had questions for the lawyers supporting the controversial theory.
Your position seems to go further than Chief Justice Rehnquist's position in Bush v. Gore, where he seemed to acknowledge that state courts would have a role interpreting state law and that federal court review of that should be, in his words, deferential.
DeForest Soares Jr. is also worried what this case could mean. He's an independent, a former Secretary of State of New Jersey, and former chair of the Election Assistance Commission under President George W. Bush. Here's his conversation with Scott Tong.
You know, I was reporting in the state of Pennsylvania during this election cycle, and you know what was in play was rules or guidance on how early can you vote if you have a mail-in ballot. You know, where are the mail-in ballot boxes? How early can those be available? Is that the kind of thing where state lawmakers can say, we are saying no to those election rules?
That's exactly right. This places the legislature as the ultimate elections administration agency and authority. And it undermines the whole idea of checks and balances. It undermines the idea that there's an executive branch, a judicial branch that interprets laws and their application, and then a legislative branch that passes the laws.
If the Supreme Court rules in favor of this theory, could state lawmakers overturn the electors in a presidential election, the people who go to Washington, D.C. as their state electors? What are some possibilities of how this could play out in so chaos, perhaps?
Well, to the extent that federal electors are part of the federal election system, the legislature would have the ultimate say on the legitimacy or lack thereof of federal electors, I suppose. the day-to-day implications are very serious because, to your point, there are so many administrative decisions that have to be made that impact voting in this country. And state by state, we know that historically it's been state legislatures that had poll tax laws. It was state legislatures that forbade African-Americans and women from voting even after the United States Constitution was passed. And so without any checks or balances, state legislatures historically have proven to be politically partisan and to create outcomes that favor the party that's in charge.
So, you know, as you're saying, this from the perspective of voters, I mean, this is a question of the franchise, right? Whether they get access to the polls, as you've been describing. I want to ask you about the court of public opinion. That is, you know, so long as this theory is out there before the Supreme Court and being debated publicly, does it give a kind of legal cover for election deniers?
Election deniers are of a different breed, and I think they raise questions that far exceed constitutional boundaries. Now, to your question specifically, however, if election deniers, for instance, controlled a particular state legislature, and in that instance, the independent state legislature theory was in place, that would simply mean that that legislature could determine the outcome of an election because they would have ultimate power to certify or not certify an election.
This is the John Eastman theory, is it not? That is the lawyer advising Donald Trump in 2020.
That is certainly his theory. It's a part of his theory. His theory is much more complex than that. But at the end of the day, if politics rules governance, and governance is simply a tool of politics, then we've basically undermined the foundational principles of our democracy. Politics is a part of our democratic process, but at the end of the day, governance is supposed to be of the people, by the people, and for the people. And one of our big picture challenges in this country is that we're so accustomed to turning over our governance to our politicians that they sometimes seem inseparable. In this instance, if this case goes the way the proponents want it to go, they want the politics and the governance to become one.
If for a moment I can kind of pose an argument from the other side, the National Republican Redistricting Trust is one of the groups supporting this independent state legislature theory. And this group argues that in striking down the map, the Supreme Court in North Carolina engaged in unconstitutional lawmaking. Their argument is that in the Constitution, when it comes to elections, courts cannot engage in what they argue is lawmaking.
Well, what's interesting about that theory is that the legislature makes the laws and the courts interpret the laws. And so that argument is just so weird and so unprecedented. I admire the lawyers who can even respond to it. The state legislatures create elections laws. The state courts interpret the meaning and the intent of those laws. And so to the extent that the federal constitution, which protects the rights of states to handle their business, as it were, and that gives federal judges the only authority to review the decision of a state court, that's constitutional. I'm not an attorney, but, you know, having been a state and federal elections official, it's always been clear that there are state laws, there are federal laws, and the federal constitution would never abridge the right of states to interpret and implement its own elections laws, whether it's state elections or federal elections. What's interesting is that you have people who are typically states' rights people arguing for non-states' rights constructs.
We have been talking to DeForest Soaries Jr., former Secretary of State of New Jersey, speaking to us about the big case before the Supreme Court today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. As always, there's a lot more to listen to at hereandnow.org. One story you'll find there, the CDC reported a record number of overdose deaths last year. But despite bipartisan agreement on the need to do more, Congress is about to let its current term end without doing much to address the crisis.
Congress did pass a substantial bill in 2018 aimed at expanding access to treatment and broadly reducing the number of overdose deaths. Since then, we haven't really seen any continued momentum from lawmakers on Capitol Hill.
Today's stories were produced by Hafsa Qureshi, Sam Rafelson, and Jill Ryan. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Technical direction today from Max Liebman and Mike Moschetto. Max, Mike, and I wrote the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.